Wonderful introduction there, called Listen by Eddie Harris. Hello, how are you doing today? This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrecht Lead. It's October the 26th. Free for All Friday, right here on Lead Stories. Bring your considered thoughts and opinions and share them. But be prepared, folks are listening. And they are likely to take you on. So that's my only warning to you. Call 1-888-874-4888. There's a lot to talk about. Many developments in this past week. But you are dictating the program today with your thoughts and opinions and ideas. 1-888-874-4888. I got a lot of reaction while I'm going to yap while you call, but I got a lot of reaction this week from two guests in particular, Lawrence Guyot of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and yesterday's guest, Father Roy Bourgeois of the School of America's Watch. And there was a common thread between the two of them, of course. The first and obvious one was that they've been at the business of activism for a very long time, almost 50 years averaging, the way they've been involved for all these years. But they talked about the fact that struggle is a long-term process, and it involves dealing with less than perfect conditions and less than ideal solutions. And where we are as a group, in fact, I just responded to one of the callers today, an email, thank you very much for it, saying that basically he had to hold his nose, he thought, but he voted, but angry. And I responded that, hey, you know, join the crowd. That's where I am as well. It is not a good scenario, but then we have to put things in perspective. When was it for any people who see themselves as part of a group that continually is ostracized or neglected or ignored, when was it ever ideal? It's never an ideal process. And we have to kind of do some tinkering with the formula here, in that expectations are always based on idealisms. And expectations, now we have to grow up in a way. We have to mature as political people and see that the challenge constantly facing us, confronting us, is one in which we have to navigate the vast seas of gray. We see the world as black and white mostly, but it actually is gray. We have to discern of this vast sea of gray, how much of it is black, how much of it is white, but we can't see the world strictly in terms of what is black and white, because that now lifts us into a whole other realm, and it is a realm of unreality. Even as we see, or we tend to see the world as black and white, you know, it's either this or that, we always have to caution ourselves that largely the world is gray, and we just have to navigate through it and make the best of a situation. But that does not mean we stop fighting. Because even as we struggle also with imperfection and limitations and things that are wrong on our part, it's never an ideal response. We like to think that the world ought to operate in a particular way, and in that regard, I use the word idealism. We have a sense that it ought to be X, Y, Z, but it's not going to be that way. So from the very beginning, ours should be a position of what is practical, what is pragmatic, what is achievable and doable. And this has been my central criticisms of alternative movements and parties, that they're more obsessed, it seems to me, with the ideology of things, getting people to understand their ideology. And it is really not very relevant to most people. What is relevant is, what is your plan? What is your structure? What is it that you hope to achieve? And to what degree have you organized yourselves to achieve the goals that you articulate? And that's basically it. Pragmatic, practical things like that. I don't want to hear about, you know, what your belief system is. It's good, I'm sure, at some point. It's a nice point of reference. But in the practical business of politics, literally, the number one thing is, are you going to win at whatever it is that you set out to do? Are you prepared to fight? Are you prepared to win? And are you prepared to respect the input that you are inviting by saying, I am ready and I would like you to join me, but I'm ready. You have to prove that you're ready. It's like you're inviting somebody to dinner and they show up and then you say, well, what did you bring? You know, that's not the way to get people excited. That's not the way to do it. And that's been a huge disappointment to me. I mean, just me. I look at the movements and they're immersed in thought and not action and not considered action or planned action. But anyway, enough of me and what I think. What are you thinking today? That's the issue. 1-888-874-4888. That's the number to call. We'll take this very short break and come back to your thoughts and get the ball rolling. Thank you, Eddie Harris, with Listen Here. And that's exactly what we're trying to do today. As others speak and we listen at 1-888-874-4888. It is Free for All Friday. This is your forum, so take advantage of it. But beware, beware, folks are listening and they're likely to take you on. Thomas from New Jersey, you're up. Hello.
Yes, my name is Joe. I'm from New Jersey, and I just
had Joe.
Yeah. So I was part of the, and still am, the Occupy, you know, movement and everything. And what I've noticed is that a lot of what's happening now is I think the Occupy name is, you know, kind of falling off, but it doesn't mean that the impact isn't there. And I met a lot of like-minded people and.
Oh, hello?
Am I still there?
Oh, yes, it kind of faded there for a minute.
Okay. So I've noticed that, what it produced with the movement produced locally was a group of like-minded people. So when it's time to bring them together, we don't have to use a banner of Occupy anymore. But on the other note, I can't say that I'm the best organizer or, I'm not saying I'm good at it or anything, but How do you break through to, you know, like the, you know, just to get people off the couch to, like, it's not the fact, it's not that they don't care, because they'll answer, you know, you can get them to sign a petition or you can get them to do anything as long as it's web-based. But the minute that they need to walk outside their front door to stand on a corner or go sit in and lobby for anything, there's a disconnect. And I wonder, is that just American? Is that just part of being an American where, you know, you just don't have the feeling that you need to do much physically?
I don't know that that's the case. I think there are a couple of things. I'm looking at it now from the outside, okay, because I was not part of the Occupy movement, but I'm going to give you my views from the outside. Clearly, this movement had a very, very strong impact on the consciousness, not just nationally, but internationally. And in that regard, the Occupy movement belonged within the context of global considerations as to the relationship between citizens and the systems that govern them. So to that degree, very successful. What I think the disconnect was, and still is, with the Occupy movement was that, and it's not that movements have to have a leader as such, but it came across, it was terrifying to many people, because it seemed to be out of control in terms of a structure. And people are very hesitant to do something like that. People of a certain age, meaning people like me, we want directed action, but we want structure. And when you are involved in a movement where you don't know where the nexus of controls are within the movement itself, who is making the decisions, what are they deciding to do, what is the process, what is the structure. Now, it is the nature of many spontaneous reactions to just simply be. But at a certain point, and Occupy moved beyond that point, I think, it started out as sporadic, but it has to deal now with the question of structure. You got to have a structure. And in the absence of structure, you become what the apparatus that you're fighting against begins to demonize you as. And they begin to win at this on a psychological level, saying, you know, these are a bunch of anarchistic people. These are people who just are rabble rousers, and they lack discipline and they lack direction and all of that kind of stuff. And to some degree, the Occupy movement has to deal with that. It's a valid criticism. It is also important to note that this movement energized people. This movement brought attention to internal disaffection. And this movement is responsible in a large part of refocusing the discussion. So it achieved a great deal. It now must grow up. It now must do the things. If it intends to remain a movement, it has to grow up and do the things that movements should do if they are engaged in long-term change. They have to have a structure, and they have to have a process. That's just my view.
Thanks.
What do you think?
Well, I think I agree with you. And what I think that was, I don't think what people understand is that I think that what the movement's done for me, I was one of those that was sitting on the couch and doing absolutely nothing. And I just had to do something. The call to arms, it was just too much. And, you know, there's plenty of times where I would call a general assembly in my town. And, you know, it'd be me and three other people show up, and, you know, you would send out the words of maybe 150. And after a while, you're just like, what's the point? Really, what's the point? So basically what I did was I decided I physically had to do something, and I decided mm-hmm. to plant a small garden in my front yard and give the food out. And I know that that doesn't seem connected, but I really do believe in the collective unconscious that Carl Jung spoke about. And I met, I would say I met 50 or 60 people that they just didn't understand why would somebody grow a vegetable garden in their front yard and put a table out and just give the stuff away. And it just started this momentum, you know, like it just started this spark that started other things and other things. And I just think that I in my own opinion, I think that, you know, it's the hard work. It's like you said, and now it's going local. And so, like, I've quit using the banner of Occupy. Like, I still check in to see what New York's doing. I check in to see what other people's doing in Occupy. But you don't have to hang that banner anymore. But I think the thing is like you said, like, I think that if I connect the dots on where my passion for change started, it was there. And
great.
And now it comes down to the hard work of making third parties in small towns or whatever it's going to take. You know, in my case, I have this huge into, you know, I've talked to you before, I think. But anyway, I live in mm-hmm. Princeton.
I remember very well.
Right. Okay. So we basically have this bill in the state of New Jersey that would basically exempt private colleges from having to go through any kind of boarding, you know, any kind of board to build. They can just basically, if this bill passes, they can do whatever they want to in a town without the town having any say-so. It's crazy. It's taxation without representation. And you know, tomorrow we're going to have a booth out, and we're going to have, there's already petitions, you know, I mean, there's already really important organizations that are against this. And I'm just saying that the hard, you know, like it's just put one foot in front of the other. And I'm a real idealistic person. I feel like anyone in a leadership position has to think about saving this earth, or you shouldn't be a leader. Like, and I don't care what institution you're in charge of. If you don't have a second bottom line that cares about this earth, then you've lost the reason why you're a leader, I believe. And that's going to be, as the Irish say, it's going to be the bang in the ear that a Princeton University is going to hear from us. Because all this stuff we've been talking about, there's a forum because the president is stepping down, and she's the most socially unconscious person I've ever heard, you know, been in the presence of. And we're going to have a chance to have our voice of what kind of president we want at that university. That's never happened. And that's never happened. So I think the thing is that it took me a long time to figure out the ripple effect, that you can't always see exactly what was the cause of the spark, but it doesn't matter. Just walk, you know, just walk on.
I think that's a very profound thing that you just said. And I believe that when individuals are exposed to, and this is one of the benefits of, and you pointed that out, of affiliating yourself with a movement of protest, when you internalize it, you see where it matches your profound sense of outrage about systems that control you, but that are also within your ability to affect. And so you become self-mobilized to do things. And that's a very good benefit from your experience. So we are on the same page on that. But I really do believe that the movement now has to confront its own internal issues, because having grown as quickly and as voluminously as it did, it now has a constituency. And you can't behave with a constituency as if it's just a bunch of people who casually gather. You now have to deal with structure. And I know for many that sounds, you know, very, very anti-social movement, but it is the mature and responsible way to harness political energy and direct it toward particular goals and actions. Thank you so much, Joe, for participating today.
Thanks.
Thank you. 1-888-874-4888 is the number to call and participate. A very interesting thing, and it concerns how the current administration is so much like other administrations, and how money, big money, gets away with all kinds of stuff. And I'm talking about the Bank of America. The U.S. government has decided it would file a suit against Bank of America, saying that it engaged, alleging that it engaged in fraud and mortgage fraud to the extent of $1 billion in losses to the government, because the government essentially financed toxic or fraudulent mortgage loans from Bank of America that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two housing programs that government subsidized, literally bought from Bank of America under that huge program, the bailout program, from which Bank of America, the largest institution, financial institution in the United States, benefited. And so the response is, we are going to sue the Bank of America for $1 billion, and there you are. It's in the minds of the government, this is a solution. Now, here's my problem, and it is typical of the ways in which the government shows its timidity before seriously organized capital entities. We bailed these folks out. More than $470 billion went into this bailout program. They were on the brink of disaster. We brought them back. The Bank of America is now entangled in a global fraud scheme, and Barclays Bank in London has already been convicted of engaging in fraud, and it has been made to pay back hundreds of millions of dollars because it engaged in that fraud. It's called the LIBOR scandal. We'll get into that in another program. But the response I'm talking about here in the United States towards Bank of America and the allegation of fraud to the tune of $1 billion is inadequate. If the United States government were really serious, it would not just sue the bank, it would move to liquidate it, sell it off, sell all of its assets, close it down, remove or rescind its charter. That's what you do when you're serious. But this thing that they've done, if they've decided, well, okay, we're going to sue, and that's supposed to be a big deal. It isn't a big deal. Here is a financial institution, and this is, by the way, I'm going to go so far as to say, this is a threat to our national security. When banks can do these kinds of things, and I am fully aware that Bank of America has not been convicted of anything so far. It is an allegation. But even as an allegation, my point is, the U.S. government needs to send a signal to this financial community which has wrecked the economy. And it needs to say, listen, yes, we're going to sue. We'll sue for the $1 billion, but the $1 billion is a drop in the bucket of a multi-trillion dollar sector of our economy. And Bank of America is a leader of the pack. We're not even discussing the thousands of jobs it just cut in one fell swoop. We're not discussing the fraud that has been alleged. We're discussing here the pattern of behavior. And we're talking about, you know, playing ball with these banking institutions. And this is yet the latest example. Just yesterday, the Federal Reserve was asked to do something affirmatively in controlling financial institutions that are really not doing what they're supposed to do. Control them. And, you know, there's all this, well, we don't know, well, we have to see the law, we have to move very gingerly on this. No, you don't have to move gingerly on the thing. If you had enough conviction to move ahead or to proceed with a lawsuit against a bank, clearly you have enough conviction that the bank is engaging in fraud. Otherwise, you would not have brought a suit. But why not say, on top of this lawsuit, this bank, having committed a series of documented transgressions, legal transgressions, deserves to have its charter pulled. You're in charge of that. You can rescind its charter. You could say this bank ceases to exist. This bank has violated the terms of its federal charter. You're the federal government. And move in a very systematic way to liquidate its assets. And say, thus will be the fate of all or any other financial institutions that decides that they have the money to hire the lawyers, they have the power to influence opinion, they have the lobbyists to influence a policy, they're ruling the country. And our response is, oh, we'll sue? Really? Is that the best we can do? And this is the kind of behavior that is at the root of our dilemma now, which is a direct and immediate threat to our security as a nation, our global security, not just domestic, our global interests. So, I mean, it just rattled me. I can't believe that this is, I mean, the government is punking out here. The government is making it seem that they're doing something. All they're doing is engaging in legal battles, and it comes down to whose lawyers are better than whose lawyers. And they all have money, and they all have endless resources to go fight in court, and it will be for technical purposes. I'm saying the time has come, long gone actually, because this started with Bush. Bush was the one who started the TARP program. Barack Obama continued it and even upped the ante by putting so much money into it. But the bailout really was a George Bush program. Now, are we going to still continue playing ball with the banks? Is this the best we could do? Are we going to sue? No. When a bank does whatever it wants to do with a program of $417 billion of taxpayer money, it benefited from it. It didn't deserve to benefit from it, but it benefited because it had the power and the pull and the lobbyists and the force to do so. And now, with ample evidence, and I know, yes, its case hasn't been tried, and even a bank is entitled to a fair trial. I understand all of that. I'm still saying that in as much as the government decided that it would sue the bank for $1 billion, which means that really what they're fighting about right now, I'll translate that. What they're really fighting about with this notice that the government is suing is just settlement. You know, they want basically the bank would sit in a room with its team of high-powered lawyers, the government comes with its team of lawyers, and they're just going to have a nice little chat and see if they could come to a settlement. They're not interested in convicting anybody. They're not interested in criminal charges being lodged. That's not really what they want. They want some money back, and then all will be forgotten. No. In as much as you're going to sue this bank, you indicate very, very clearly that you are about to rescind its charter. You are about to liquidate its assets. That's the language they understand. And that's what the government ought to do. But this government, in the face of these financial institutions, has no guts. They've been playing ball with these folks. Rescind the charter. Shut the bank down. And collect your $1 billion. We'll take a little break. Come right back. 1-888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. By the way, you can reach me, as many of you do, at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, leadstories@gmail.com. I want to thank you for your letters and your notes and your emails. Fantastic feedback. And I'm delighted that the program is appealing to you on the level that it apparently has been and continues to do so. I really appreciate that. The point of it is we need to talk. We need to talk with each other about ideas. All ideas are valid. I think it is important. I like the idea of appreciating your journey to your idea and opinion. And we need, as a community, to develop a high tolerance level. We were very intolerant of ideas with which we differ, and that's a bad habit. We need to break it. It is important to appreciate that people take different journeys toward their ideas, and that itself is valid. So if you listen to the program with Lawrence Guyot, for example, there was a moment when there was a difference of opinion. And both people handled it very, very well. And that's the level of maturity I'm talking about. One person having a very strong idea. Obviously, his journey toward that idea brought him to that point. And that's fine. And you have to respect that, even if you disagree. But we need to have the ability to talk to each other and to appreciate another person's point of view, because their journey to their idea is very different from your own, but equally valid. And that's the point. So in that space where we understand that opinions are just that, but we can engage with each other, and therefore there's an opportunity to transmit information from one to the other. And that's really, to me, the essence of good radio. When we are talking, sharing ideas, and secure in the notion that there's no such thing as a bad idea or wrong idea, you know, or bad opinion or wrong opinion. It's just that this is where your journey has taken you, and another person has a different point of view. 1-888-874-4888. So I want to thank you for that. I also want to thank those of you who shared some time with me at the concert at St. James Presbyterian Church last Saturday. It was phenomenal. It was just phenomenal. And it was great meeting you. I hope you enjoyed yourselves, but hear this, you did a great job by just being there to signal to people that it concerns you that an institution 118 years old should continue to be a presence, such a vital presence in the community, because it has constructed so much in the way of infrastructure for the community and continues to be a cultural haven for that community. So I appreciated that you showed up as part of the Lead Stories family. All right, 1-888-874-4888. Your ideas continue today. This is the thrust of our program. So we'll hear from you. I wanted to bring to your attention also that as the race winds down, the presidential race winds down, pay attention to all the things that we've talked about that are presenting themselves, the things that are not being said, the care with which people are now talking, because now every vote counts, and you would see a great effort being made not to disturb the waters too much. The formula would be to remain dead center for Barack Obama. He's not going to veer to the right. He's not going to veer to the left. He's going to remain very center, very, very much at the center. He will absolutely not mention anything that you think is important. He's not going to do that right now. The only focus right now is winning. And in that regard, he will stick to a script. He will stick to a plan of action, which is you don't disturb anything. You don't. This is not the time to uncover any, you know, to raise any stones. This is not the time to do anything that would cause undue reaction. For Romney, he will also be minding his P's and Q's. He will go on the attack. The polls have them very much tied in this race. But I'll tell you something. As I talked about Barack Obama, and the one thing that Barack Obama did for this country and for politics and for political science is giving people an idea about the science part of political science. Now, the polls are showing whatever they show, but I can bet you that the Obama camp has invested heavily in the science of political science. I can bet you that. They know what they're doing. They have spent a huge amount of money and time and expertise in constructing a system that will deliver victory or close. But they're not winging it, is what I'm saying. They are not winging this at all. And to that extent, movements need to just take a page out of that book and have it as their template for organizing. You've got to have a system. And Barack Obama is not sharing this system with the Democratic Party or with any other Democrat. His camp devised it, they own it, and they know what they're doing. The polls, well, you have to understand that polling now is so politicized, it is so partisan, that it is all about public relations. But the groundwork, when you're doing your groundwork, when you're doing your behind the scenes, hard rubber meets the road work, you know your reality. And when you are applying science in political science, you can pretty much predict how you are going to perform, what the result is going to be, what your outcome is going to be, because you are hard at work constructing your constituencies that will deliver political victory for you. And that's even compared to Republicans. Obama's system far outweighs theirs with respect to a scientific approach to politics. So now we'll see in the end whether it in fact worked or not, or we would see whether, and Romney knows this, so what he is doing, what his camp is doing, is making most use of available media to affect the psychological orientation of voters because their system isn't working too well. You can see that. they are using public, the public's FCC regulated airwaves to influence voters, because that's their biggest weapon right now. And in order to win, they have to pander to the fears of whites in America, that the turf is being invaded at all levels, economic, political, social, and that Romney actually is the standard bearer for white privilege in America. That's the message. And when all else fails, it is the message that they return to, and that is fear. Fear and about the possibility of ultimately losing everything, because everything is being lost to black people and brown people and Asians and Mexicans. And we've got to do something. We may not like Romney, we may not like his positions, but ultimately, the main goal that he is going to secure for that sector of white America that thinks that way is that he is going to secure our space and what we are entitled to as a derivative of white skin privilege in America. Barack Obama's counter to that is he can't depend very much on just ads, and he can't depend on, you know, sympathetic coverage. He can't depend on all these things. He's got to depend on a system. And that's what I've been talking about. It is not enough to have an idea. It is not enough to have an ideology. It is not enough to simply talk about what you want to accomplish and you want people to buy into. You got to have a system that delivers victory. Now, if our movements could get that message, if our third party efforts could really like the idea that they should win at something, I think that would be great. That would be fantastic. There's nothing wrong with wanting to win, but they act like they don't want to win. To act like there's some kind of a right-wing conspiracy about winning. No, you got to win. If you're not in politics to win, you shouldn't be in politics. You should get lost. If you're going to present yourself in a political arena and you're going to go through all of these permutations as if you are a legitimate political entity, then you ought to have as a number one goal winning at something. I don't care how modest it is, but win it. We're going to go after 3 city council seats, or we're going to go after the dog catcher position. Whatever it is, you identify it, you structure a system that will deliver it, and you win it. And that lifts the burden, the psychological burden off of you, that every time you show up, when these races are run, every 4 years, you are asking people to invest in a losing proposition. How much of that could people take? I personally don't identify well with losing. I don't identify well with failure. And repeated failure is an anesthetic. They need to get this message. It numbs people's motivation and belief and credibility in what it is you have to say. And a lot of these parties are well-intentioned, but they will not move off of a failing model. And it's going to be to their doom. And it is a waste of effort. If you truly are a party of the people, spend the time getting to know the people. But there are communities that have never heard of you. And you're okay with that. I remember Ralph Nader running. Nobody in Bedford-Stuyvesant knew who Ralph Nader was. nobody really had ever seen him. He never passed through there. And Ralph Nader pretty much made it clear it was really not relevant to him to be relevant to black people. He was talking to a whole different group of people. And yet, we are supposed to regard him as, quote, progressive and invest in that. Wrong, wrong move. The Green Party is saying that it is an all-encompassing thing and whatnot. Very good. Where are you? When was the last time you went to a community board meeting? What are your strategies for cultivating a constituency that has probably a keen interest? And here's a third thing that really bugs me, and that is, again, the parallelism, which is you are deciding what the issues are. And therefore, anybody wanting to support you will have to recognize your priorities as their priorities. Wrong move. Wrong move. I remember I was starting a paper in the city of New York, and I'm a seasoned journalist, and other people were busy waxing philosophic about what the editorial content should be. And I said, we're not going to decide that. The readers or potential readers would decide that. I had to fight to get that point across. But okay, a little bit of money was found to do a little poll of potential readers in the tri-state area. And guess what? Not a single thing that folks thought was important was on that list. They didn't want news. They want analysis. The number one thing they wanted was not news, but history. And second on the list was they wanted to know what things were happening in the community. Now, all the news professionals were there busy talking about feature stories and investigative pieces and all. None of that mattered. And guess what? I formulated the editorial content to that which we were told through the poll. And guess what? Within 2 months, we went way past the circulation of the mainstream paper, the main competitive paper in our city. And we just blew everybody away. That's the wisdom of taking instruction from the people you think should be followers. But if you're a leader, you understand that leadership is in the followers. Okay, thus endeth my sermon for today. We'll get to each other again on Monday. And really, thank you so much. It is such a joy and a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company Monday through Friday. But tell a friend and let's grow this group. Okay? See you. Take care.